Accession number 20895, Reel 6.
John Deere, Reel 6. Although Ian had been wounded two or three times during the Normandy campaign, none of his wounds were serious enough to be for him to be evacuated. I was particularly glad to find Peter Winston back. Peter, the other subaltern in E Troop, had been detached from us about a week before D-Day, and he, in fact, parachuted in with the 9th Battalion Parachute Regiment, the idea being that he would be a liaison officer between nine para who were attacking the Merville Battery and 4-5 Commando, which was going to be operating in the Merville Battery area. He had landed some 20 miles away from the planned DZ and travelling with an RAF pilot who had been shot down. They eventually landed up somewhere near Bordeaux, were captured by the Germans, but later managed to, by feigning illness, to be released when the Germans retreated. Peter had been flown back by the Americans a couple of weeks before we met again at Petworth. When I arrived back with the unit, Nicol Gray told me I was to become adjutant. And the previous adjutant, Brian White, had been killed in Normandy. His place had been taken temporarily by Bill Neves, who was the OC of the support troop, and Bill returned to his previous position as troop commander of the support troop. We left Petworth camp sometime the end of September and spent 2 weeks at Eastney Barracks, where Nicol Gray decided that we ought to get some drill on the playground before we returned to our normal billets, where ceremonial drill was very seldom seen. From Eastley we moved on to billets at Beck's Hill, and we understood that we were waiting to go to the Far East. We all assumed at that time that this meant joining up with the 3rd Commander Brigade, which was then operating in Burma. But I learned since the war, from one of Winston Churchill's books, either his own memoirs or his history of the war, or from Martin Gilbert's Life of Churchill, that the 1st Commander Brigade, which is what we now became, was the only British land force which would operate in the Pacific with the Americans. Perhaps fortunate for us, we didn't go there. Life at Beck's Hill was pleasant enough. We were still very much under strength. I should think probably at least 10% under strength. A number of the people who, like myself, had been wounded in Normandy rejoined the unit, and our training there was fairly, I would say, leisurely, but nothing of great interest took place. We went on leave at Christmas, and when we came back a few days after we returned, sometime in the first week, I think, of January, we were told that we were going to move. Obviously, the short notice given meant that we were not going to the Pacific. I was sent to B Troop as the B Troop commander. They had not had a troop commander since their return from Normandy. And Bill Neves once again became adjutant. 13th of January, we left from Tilbury for Ostend. And from there we moved into Holland. I had been a little concerned at taking over B Troop, glad there was to have my own troop command, but the P Peter Riley, who was the senior subaltern in the troop, had been commanding them for about a month and had been in the troop since the commando formed. However, we had managed to have one troop meeting before we left Bex Hill, at which we decided that the name Baker Troop, which is what we were known in the signals jargon of those days, was a little too pacific. And so we renamed ourselves as Butcher Troop, and we acquired a flag which consisted of the butcher's cleaver with the troop motto underneath, "Dash on regardless." Bob Aylett, who was my troop sergeant major, who had been with 40 Commando in the Mediterranean and won a very good military medal there, was delighted with the troop flag and carried it under his battle dress smock wherever we moved subsequently. The 19th of January saw us taking up positions along the River Maas near the village of Barlow, B-A-A-R-L-O, the intention being that we would patrol across the river in order to inflict some punishment on the enemy. It was, of course, very cold. There was snow everywhere, and it was difficult to find suitable positions from which we could cover the river in case the Germans patrolled across it and attacked us, and at the same time keep people alive rather than leaving them lying on the cold ground. However, on the 22nd of January, at short notice, we handed over to another army unit and moved out by lorry to the town of Echt, E-C-H-T, and came under command of the 7th Armored Division. We were told that night when we arrived at Echt that the brigade's task was to advance on the left flank of the division and clear the enemy from the railway line on our right to the River Maas or the Juliana Canal on our left flank. We settled that night, the 22nd of January, on the floor, that is the troop, the whole troop, on the floor of a cafe in Echt, with just our uniform, but we were so close and huddled together that we all seemed to sleep quite satisfactorily. Soon after dawn the next morning, we set out. 6th Commando were in the lead, followed by ourselves. 3rd Commando, which had been detached, joined up with us later. The 4th unit in the brigade, 46th Commando, which had replaced 4th Commando, had been detached on arriving in Holland and had been sent to Antwerp in an anti-parachute role. So for the moment, the brigade consisted of 3 units only. We set forth along the canal, the Juliana Canal. It was a fairly bright morning, no wind, and it was a peaceful business. 6th Commando had crossed the canal over the ice in the early hours and had taken the village of Masperacht, I think it was, without any opposition, and we then passed through them, arriving at a village called Brachtebeek. Here, the order of march was A troop in the lead, followed by E troop, then by B, and C and D were behind us. In the village of Brachtebeek, up to then had been a fairly straightforward march along a road, came to a halt, and while we waited for orders, the village came under some artillery fire, and then over the radio we received the order for E troop followed by B to advance from Brachtebeek directly on a stream which faced us, called the Montfortebeek. Our objective for the commander had been the town of Linné, which must have been about 4 or 5 miles away. The leading troop, A troop, had been following a road, but we were then to move off the road and take this track, which moved alongside an embankment towards the stream called the Montfortebeek, the object being to obtain a bridgehead over the Montfortebeek stream. So E troop moved off, followed by B. I moved at the head of B troop, and we moved away from the houses of Brachtebeek, and moved along at the foot of the embankment. After about 100 yards or so, I heard heavy small arms fire ahead of me. E troop halted, and I moved forward to contact Ian Beadle to see what was happening. As I reached Ian, I saw a group of men carrying one or two wounded with them withdrawing onto the main E troop position. The leading section of E troop, leading subsection, somewhere around 10 men, had been badly hit with two or three killed and two or three wounded. I said to Ian, having looked at the map, that I would investigate what the map showed to be a marsh on the left flank, and if it was possible to get across that marsh, I would continue on to Montfortebeek on his left flank. While we were having this discussion, my troop sergeant major, Bob Aylett, came up to me and said that 4 tanks had moved up and were with the remainder of B troop 100 yards behind me. Ian Beadle and I went back to the tanks, and before I got there, I called Peter Riley, told him to take his section, which was then about 18 to 20 men, and to move over the marsh, if they could do so, and that the ice did not give way, and to try and see if there was a way forward to the Montfortebeek. But knowing that A troop had been in trouble, and now E, I warned him not to get involved, but just find a way across the marsh. Ian and I then turned to the troop tank commander, and Peter Riley set off with his section. After a short interval, I heard small arms fire in the direction in which Peter had moved, so telling Ian to get the tank to fire on any known enemy positions, I called out to B troop to follow me, and we set off after D troop. I was mentally cursing Peter for having fallen into the same sort of trap that A and E troops had fallen. I found myself moving across the ice on the marsh without any problems, and then very easily jumping the narrow Montfortebeek stream to see Peter with two or three of his men facing some 5 Germans. Peter said that as he'd moved through the marsh, he had seen Germans withdrawing from the direction of E troop and had instantly attacked them. He thought he had killed about 5, had captured 5, and 1 or 2 others had run away. The remainder of his section were lining the gully in which we now found ourselves. This was a sort of V-shaped gully. The base of the V, an inverted V-shaped gully, the base of the V being alongside the Montfortebeek stream, the apex of the V, which was perhaps 80 yards away, pointing at Linné, the town, which was the commander's objective. I settled the rest of the troop into this gully, and returned then to Peter Riley. I was a little uncertain about the next move. My attempt to pass a message back to command headquarters, giving our position and saying that we were now over the Montfort Beak, failed to get through because the radios were not working. I was reluctant to send the prisoners back under escort because I expected to be counterattacked at any moment. So I told Jock Irvin, my orderly, to stand on a small mound, face back towards E Troop, throw his berry in the air to indicate that he was happy, which would at least let E Troop know what was happening. And Jock returned saying the E Troop Sergeant Major, whom we both knew, Ted Cager, had responded by throwing his berry in the air. So at least Ian Beadle knew that we were in a happy position. We waited there for the expected counterattack, but nothing happened. And sometime later, I sent the prisoners back with a small guard. And shortly after this, the seer, Nicol Gray, arrived, said that he was going to send another troop up, D Troop, to support me. And also said that I should remember I had a regiment of Royal Artillery on call if required. D Troop arrived and they took up position on the western side of the gully, with B Troop concentrating on the eastern side, facing across an open field and a windmill. And covering also the rear of the position. I was concerned about the possible approach through the Montfort Beak stream, which was covered with trees on either side, but this was something I had to put up with. I could not cover it except by the rear position, which had really no field of fire down the stream. By now it was dark, some food had been sent up to us, and then we came under a short period of intense shell fire. D Troop had one man killed, the Troop Sergeant Major, Ron Keynes, who served in HMS Howe with me, was wounded, and the two men were wounded in E Troop. I have a doubt about this, and I've still not been able to settle it, even 50 years afterwards, whether these men were wounded by this German fire or whether they were wounded by the fire I brought down on our position later on. Not long after the enemy fire, things seemed to quieten down, and I settled down in my slit trench with Jock Irvin. I don't know how long I've been asleep, not very long, but I was woken up to be told that Marine Laidler, who was on watch at the position overlooking the open field on our right and the windmill area, could hear something. So I got out of the trench and went over and joined Laidler. Looking across the snow-covered field, I could see nothing, but I could hear a sort of clink, clink noise, a metallic noise. I decided to put up a flare and also alerted the men on this side of the troop area. I should mention here that our departure from England had been at very short notice, and on arriving in Holland with the very cold weather, we were advised that the oil used to lubricate our rifles and light machine guns were unsuitable for the cold weather. I've never been able to satisfy myself whether this meant that the oil was too thick or whether it was too thin. But in any event, we were advised to keep the bolts of the rifles and the Bren guns moving, because if we did not, they were apt to seize up. this was the situation in which we found ourselves now. We were naturally reluctant, particularly at night, to be moving bolts of rifles and run guns all the time. It was against our training to be making a noise. And I remember Bob Aylett at this particular period, as I was waiting to put up a flare, breathing hot breath down the Bren gunners to make sure that their bolts were moving. But in case we were in problems like this, I called the Piat up to my side and was prepared to use that. Now, when everything was as ready, and though it sounds a long time, it was in fact a very short period, I put up a flare. There was no wind, but then in light of the flare, I could see probably not more than 60 yards away a bunch of obviously Germans in white snowsuits. They, according to their training, rather like ours, when a flare went up, you stood still and didn't move. They had stopped, which to my mind was very foolish because they were so close to us. There was nothing they could do. The answer should have been to rush us, but fortunately they didn't. And as soon as I saw them, I yelled fire, and we fired with rifles and Brens at this bunched group. My initial thought was that there were at least 20 men there. We found out later from a prisoner we took that in fact there were four, of whom only one got away unwounded. In case the small arms fire we were producing was not enough, I told the Piat to also fire into the group. And as the Piat burst, it added to the illumination, this incredible display of white, almost like fireworks, bursting in this group of men. I put up another flare. There was no movement from the group in front, and called for fire to be stopped. I was always conscious of the fact that we had nearly run out of ammunition in Normandy, and I didn't want this to happen again. As the last flare flickered down, I did see one German running away on the left flank, and I thought we had probably killed enough, and I let him go without having him fired at. While the troop had been happily firing away with small arms, I was conscious of the covered approach through the trees on the Montfortebeek, which was not being covered by fire. So once I was happy that the Germans to our immediate front were not a danger, I dashed back a few yards to where the signalers were, got into their slit trench, and passed a message to command headquarters asking for a troop fire on the Montfortebeek, giving the firing point as something like 50 yards from our troop position. I shouted at the troop to get under cover as our own artillery fire was coming down. Very shortly after my message, the artillery fire came down, and although there was no movement or sound from the area, the next morning, before we were relieved, I did move a little way down the gully and found two dead Germans. So my thoughts about a possible movement through the Montfortebeek had been correct. The rest of the night passed quietly, and before daybreak the next morning, we were relieved by 6 commando, who were then to move down the Montfortebeek and continue the brigade advance in that direction. B Troop was to rejoin the rest of the commando in the Brechtebeek area in reserve. The following day, the 24th or it may have been the 25th of January, the town of Lille was taken by 3 commando, together with tanks from the armored division. And 45, still in reserve, B and E troops found themselves sharing a largish house near the River Maas, which was where there was no activity of any interest. On the morning of the 27th of January, I was called to an O group, and we were told that that night we were to do two operations. The River Maas by our front was carried at a wide bend, a sort of a U-shaped bend. The ground in the centre of the U, as it were, was in fact an island, because there was a lock at the northern end. And this area, to which we gave the code name Belle Isle, was occupied by Germans, believed to be at something like platoon strength. The divisional commander wanted information on the enemy in the area of Mirum, the next village or small town north of Linné. In order to obtain this information, D Troop would attack Belle Isle, and once they had succeeded in taking Belle Isle, D Troop would then pass across the Maas, cross Belle Isle itself, carrying its assault boats, put the river on the far side of Belle Isle, and then cross the river again to do a raid on Mirum. It was hoped to get a rope across the Maas from our position to Belle Isle, and so use this rope to have a sort of to get the canvas assault boats, which were the only ones available, across the Maas without having to have them filled with paddlers. The only river craft available were these canvas boats, which could be folded up. And as far as B Troop was concerned, we would paddle them across to Belle Isle, then fold them up, carry them across the island, make them up into boats again, and use them on the raid to Mirum. The Maas was running at about 4 or 5 knots, we were told, and therefore required a fair number of men. They normally carried, I think, 12 men, and it needed a fair number of men to paddle them across, hence the idea of using the rope to have a sort of ferry operation. Well, I'll say nothing else about that particular intended operation, because it didn't work out as planned. We moved into our positions near the riverbank, and I remember seeing the tall figure of Peter Winston, who had been transferred to D Troop, and I made some fatuous remark to him about his hunting days. We'd been friends since we joined the commander together. And then B Troop moved into the lee of the riverbank, awaiting our movement across the river. The attack by D Troop, it was intended that they should attack without any artillery support, in order that the enemy would not be alerted, and so it was hoped that B Troop would, in their raid, would find an enemy who was not aware of anything happening. It seemed to me to be a rather small hope, but there it was. While we were waiting in our position, and we waited and waited and waited, there was then the sound of heavy small arms fire on Belle Isle, followed shortly afterwards by our own artillery fire going down. And clearly things had not been going according to plan. We continued to wait and wait and wait, getting colder and colder.